Chair. Thank you very much, Alan. So I want to start this evening by doing a quick update of the situation in relation to GM crops and farming, and then to discuss the issue we're really here tonight to talk about, which is patents and patents applied to intellectual property rights in relation to living organisms. What I think is certainly true for us farmers is that we are now living in very interesting times, where not just the turmoil in the financial markets that we're struggling with at the moment, but if you remember last year, we were facing turmoil in the commodity markets. We saw the price of wheat rise from £80 a tonne to £160, £170 a tonne, and then crash right back down again, so we're back near the £80 a tonne mark now. I think it's worth having a look at how this rollercoaster effect came about. It seems to me there were three main issues that fed into this. Firstly, there was a growing shortage of grain throughout the world. Governments have consistently failed to recognise that they needed a buffer of grain to ensure carryover for the following year. We had ministers effectively saying that we could wander off as a wealthy nation, pushing our shopping trolley in front of us, fill it up in the rest of the world, and then bring it back to feed the 60 million people who live here. And suddenly it began to dawn on them that they might wander off with a shopping trolley, but they're going to come back with it half full, and there certainly weren't any bog-off offers out there to be had. The second series of reports that came out that had an implication on this was reports on population and speculative population looking 30, 40 years ahead. And people were saying that we could see our population in the world increase by about 50% in the next 20 or 30 years. How accurate that is, we'll only know in 20 or 30 years' time. Whether those people were actually putting out these rather speculative figures to suit their own means is debatable. Certainly there are to think about increased population meets the demands of some corporate entities in this world. But whether that coupled with the shortage of food began to raise major issues. And then George Bush waded in with heavy subsidies for ethanol production from maize. And the USA started with about 3 years ago, 40 million tonnes of maize going into ethanol production. And suddenly, they were taking 80 million tonnes last year. This year, they're forecast to have capacity for about 120 million tonnes of maize. That then created fertile ground for speculators. They moved in, and the price roared up. And now the speculators have moved out, and the price has gone, wow, straight down. And actually, in the last year, we have seen a huge increase, really, about 40 million tonnes increase in the world production of grains. But what wasn't, so the follow-on to this demand was that we've got to feed the world. This panic sort of set in amongst politicians and others, this desperate need to increase the amount of food that this planet produces. And everybody, every snake oil salesman out there jumped on the bandwagon, and along with it, the biotech companies and their proponents. And they were pushing GM as the answer for feeding the world into the future. What wasn't quite so well published at the time were two other reports. One of them looked at the availability of arable land in the rest of the world. And a country like Brazil, which is a superpower in terms of agricultural production now, still has a further... still has a further 19 million hectares of land available, and that's going without going into the rainforest. Yes, there's been an environmental impact.
I gave up. Yes, there would be an environmental impact.
Is it me?
That's special. That's special.
Where is it?
Special
with that. All right. Yes, there would be an environmental impact if Brazil used that 90 million hectares. But they would then, if that land is available for land for production now. It's actually in between what they're already farming without necessarily breaking into land that hasn't already been cleared for cultivation. And there was another paper that came out looking at the availability of land in Central and sub-Saharan Africa. And that identified 239 million hectares of land as being available for biofuel production in sub-Saharan Africa. And for someone like myself, who I was 19 when those pictures appeared of the starving children in Ethiopia, and Bob Geldof came on my TV screen and we had Band-Aid, that was a very instrumental moment in my life. It was very influential on me as an individual. And the idea that we've still got that part of the world with chronic food problems, food shortages, and yet we've got 239 million hectares of land available. It seems to me that you need the same criteria for fuel that you need for food. You need soil, you need water, and you need know-how for both. And the idea that people are starving in Central Africa with that available, to me, is a madness. And then a further report came out last year, mainly from universities in the United States, looking at the yields of GM crops, the crops that are being commercialized at the moment, the herbicide-tolerant crops, and the crops that produce their own insecticide, the BT crops. And those research papers demonstrated that GM crops do not give a yield increase. In fact, a number of them demonstrated that GM crops suffer possibly a 5 or 8% yield decrease. And so the idea that you can come forward now and claim that the answer to feeding the world in the immediate future is the GM crops that are being commercialized at the moment is a madness. Having said that, Monsanto are now bringing out a soya plant they're calling Ready to Yield. And this plant is a GM plant, and it has about a 5% yield increase over its GM equivalent. So that it possibly, if you accept that it's a 5% yield disadvantage for a GM crop, it brings it up to parity with its conventional equivalent. But the yield benefit from this ready-to-yield plant has come from hybridization. And hybridization is a conventional breeding technique. So they've taken a conventional breeding bred plant, then added the trait, and called it ready-to-yield. And what I think is significant with this particular development is that they're not going to make, at least as far as I'm aware, they're not going to make the conventional version of this increased yield soya available to farmers, conventional farmers or organic farmers, to benefit from. That then has to raise real questions about control of the seed trade, when companies can limit what is being made available to farmers, limit the choice of the farmers, and in turn limit the choice of the consumer. And at the same time, we've also, that yield increase is from the land we have now is a challenge. But the real challenge, if we're going to increase yield around the world, is to start addressing things like drought tolerance, saline tolerance, and nutritional enhancement in our crops. But GM crops, again, are failing to deliver on their promise. There are no commercially available drought-tolerant crops. There are no commercially available saline-tolerant crops. There are no commercially available nutritionally enhanced crops. And yet quietly, and much more quietly, conventional breeding is addressing these issues in particular areas in the world, generally on a localized basis, so it's a variety that meets the immediate local requirements. But they are addressing it. So nutritionally enhanced sweet potato in Kenya, that was done for about a £300,000 bill donated by the Kenyan government. £8 million was spent on a genetically modified version that never came to the market. And nor, sadly, is GM increasing profitability for farmers. A recent report from the University of Missouri actually questions whether farmers should grow GM crops at all, because particularly with the recent increases in the price of Roundup, glyphosate, linked to the price of phosphate rather than oil. We've seen Roundup in some parts increase by about 3 times. And that now makes the economics of growing GM crops very questionable in comparison with their conventional counterparts. And then, if the farmer can actually get a premium of possibly as much as £35 per tonne for a GM-free soya plant, assuming he's got access to a market, then obviously that would be far more advantageous to the farmer financially than growing the GM equivalent. So GM is failing, and I think one of the main messages I want to bring tonight is that we need a change in direction, particularly in a change in direction in research and development. So much time, money and effort has gone into developing GM over the last 15 years, largely to the detriment of conventional breeding techniques and also cultural and mechanical alternatives to the GM technique. But I think we are now falling behind. We're finding that many of our agrochemicals are now being withdrawn from the market. This is going to create a real problem for us conventional farmers into the future, because we're not going to have the new chemicals coming through to help us combat the problems. And I think what we're seeing is a legacy of 15 years ago. The decision was made, we've got the future is GM. So who would invest in a new range of herbicides if everything in 15 years' time is going to be genetically modified to be resistant to Roundup? Nobody's going to come forward with that kind of venture capital in that situation. And I feel we're sort of reaping the reward of that now. So I think one of the major problems, and probably an area where I'm hoping we're going to find a lot more compatibility between the very polarized argument that is developed around GM, is the issues of patents and how people, the biotech industry, is protecting its intellectual property rights, not through the royalty system that us farmers understand, where a company like Nickerson's up in Laos will develop a new variety of wheat, and then us farmers pay them a royalty on that wheat. And we understand the situation, we accept it. They own that variety, but they don't own wheat. The situation that's occurring now through the patent system being used with living organisms is suddenly they're turning around and saying, I own wheat. First he was telling me this evening, somebody's now claiming they own a mouse because they've introduced one gene to it. And this game is causing huge problems. One of the very few GM developments that might have even had promise was a thing called golden rice. And normally every time I stand up, somebody will beat me over the head with golden rice as the example of how GM is actually delivering benefits, real benefits, into the world. And the idea with golden rice was it's a rice that's been enhanced to produce more carotene, and therefore people who ingest the carotene, the body will turn that into vitamin A, particularly in areas in Asia and India, there's real problems with vitamin A deficiencies. So the idea was that if this grain could be introduced into the population, it would address the vitamin A shortage. The problem is that golden rice has not been brought forward for commercialization anywhere for consideration of putting into the national list, seed lists, because it is snarled up in the most impossible legal muddle, with over 30 different companies and individuals claiming to own part of the genome. And while the lawyers are trying to sort this out, this product is stalled. Now, whether golden rice is actually significantly important is arguable. But what is also of significance here is snarled up in the same mess are drugs that could well be of advantage in treating things like HIV/AIDS and cancer. So this patents business, while they're so busy protecting their own intellectual patent rights, they're actually stopping themselves bringing anything to the market. And personally, I saw this in Minnesota 4 years ago. We were both asked to the White Earth Indian Reservation to speak. And the White Earth Indian tribe were hosting this meeting because they had a particular problem with their wild rice. Now, for thousands of years, the Native Americans have gone out and harvested their wild rice, and they paddle their canoes down the rivers, and they grab the rice plant that's growing wild in the river, and they shake it over the canoe, and what falls in the canoe they take home and forms a part of their diet, and what falls back in the water is next year's crop. It's about as sustainable as agriculture gets when you think about it. And also the wild rice plays an important part in their culture. It's part of their wedding ceremonies and other civil ceremonies like that. But someone was now claiming that they own wild rice. And the Native Americans couldn't understand how someone could own wild rice. And I have to say, I have a great deal of sympathy with that. I mean, as far as I can see, the clue's in the name. It's wild. So this is an issue that I think we have to begin to get a handle on for the sake of the future of farming and the food supply. And looking into the future where GM is the beginning of biotech, there are far more powerful tools coming along. Synthetic biology, anyone who heard Craig Venter giving the Dimbleby lecture at Christmas time will have some idea of what synthetic biology is capable of. And like all these things, these powerful tools, they're capable of great good, they're capable of great harm. And somehow we have to, I think, as a community and as people, grab hold of this and start to bring it together. Because what I would say that the lecture tonight is called What Would GM Crops Mean for UK Farmers? Well, I'd say at the minute, GM crops would mean stable yields, static yields, certainly no increase, possibly even falling yields. It'll mean less choice for us farmers in the type of plants and the type of crops we can grow. And when patents come onto the farm, we stand to put our whole farming future and our whole farming businesses at risk through the draconian legislation surrounding patent law. But what I really fear at the moment is that with our farming leaders and our politicians so predisposed to this technology, that there is no one out there looking after the interests of either the individual grower or indeed the consumer. So this evening anyway, it's my enormous pleasure to introduce Percy Smyser. Percy is a Canadian farmer who shot to prominence through really pure bad luck. I'm sure it really was something that was visited on him rather than anything he would have volunteered for. His story is one that when I first heard it moved me to enormous anger. Others in the hall were crying. I felt a anger at the injustice, that sort of the David and Goliath situation, the injustice of this multinational bullying its way through, and one man trying to stand up and trying to win against impossible odds. It's a great story. And so please welcome Percy Smyser.
Well, thanks very much for the kind introduction, and also I want to thank everyone, all the organizers that have brought my wife and I here to England on a tour for about 10 or 12 days. Before I go any farther, I'd like to also introduce my wife, Louise. I don't know if she... Oh, there she is. And if it would not have been for her, I don't think I could have ever stood up for Monsanto. But it was many times when I felt like giving up, she'd always say to me, "Don't give up and fight for what you believe in too." So I have to give her a lot of credit and my family for standing up to Monsanto back in 1998. As was mentioned, I come from Western Canada in the heart of the grain growing area. And I think we've been really blessed in our part of the world that we can grow so many different crops. And we have seen the results of that in the people that have come from all over the world to reside and to immigrate. My wife and I were known in Western Canada as seed developers and seed savers, and that was in rapeseed. And if I happen to use the word canola, that's what we call it in Canada. And briefly, canola means, it was given that name in the late 70s, Canada oil, when they got the acid content, the uric acid content below 2% or lower. And that's why it was called canola in Canada. So we were known as seed developers, seed savers, in Canada, in canola. And when I took the family farm over from my father in 1947, I immediately started to raise canola, or rapeseed as it was known at that time. And we spent, I guess, over half a century, and we were developing new varieties of canola suitable for our climatic and soil condition, but especially for certain diseases that we had in rapeseed in Western Canada. But besides being a farmer, I was also involved with, I was mayor of my community and councillor for over 30 years. I was also a member of the provincial parliament. And in my role in government, I always felt that I was on many agricultural committees representing my province, not only provincially, but also in the federal level of rules, laws, and regulations. And I always thought I worked all my life for laws and rules that would benefit farmers. So that gives you a brief background, seed saver, seed developer, and my role in agriculture. I know many of you know the story, but I think I'll give a brief outline what happened. First of all, 1996, that's when regulatory approval was given in both countries, both our countries of the United States and Canada, for the introduction of GMOs. And there were four crops introduced at that time. That was soya, corn, or if you want to call it maize, cotton, and especially by us, rapeseed. And we were told many things at that time about GMO rapeseed. First of all, increased yields, less chemicals, more nutritious. And then the buzzwords, and now we'd be able to feed a hungry world. Now we'd always would have sustainable agriculture. So that's what farmers were told in 1996. And that also that farmers would have a choice. If they didn't want to grow GMOs, they could still be an organic farmer, or they could still be a conventional farmer. So those are some of the issues that were presented at that time, not only by companies like Monsanto, but also by the federal government, because the federal government was the one that gave regulatory approval for the introduction of GMOs. Now, 2 years later, 1998, unknown to us at that time, Monsanto had taken some samples from the ditch along one of our fields, and they laid what they called a patent infringement lawsuit against my wife and myself, and in it it said we were growing Monsanto's GMO rapeseed without a license from them. And we had never bought Monsanto seed. We had never gone to a Monsanto meeting. We didn't even know anybody from Monsanto. So it was really a surprise. But worst of all, we realized as seed developers that there's possibly that all our research in rapeseed now was, which we had developed over half a century, was now contaminated with Monsanto's GMOs. And we said to Monsanto at the time, if you have contaminated us in our rapeseed that we worked so hard for, then you should be guilty. There should be a liability issue for you contaminating our canola seeds and plants. Now, patent laws come under, in most countries, under federal jurisdiction. So we had no choice of where the case would be heard. Federal Court of Canada with one judge. And how often later on we wish that we could have a judge and jury where farmers could be on that jury that knew and understood farming. But that was not to be. Federal Court of Canada, one judge. Now it took 2 years to go to court. And in the 2 years of pretrial, Monsanto admitted that they had no record that we had ever used their seed or had bought their seed. But they said the fact that they had contaminated our seed, they now own our seed through patent law. So that's the basis it went to Federal Court of Canada. What the judge ruled, the trial judge ruled, was what made the case become internationally known overnight. And I'll give you some of the main points that he ruled on. First of all, he stated, it does not matter how a person, in my case a farmer, is contaminated. And he went on to specify how that could happen, cross-pollination, by wind, by bees, and so on, or direct seed movement with seeds, moon, and wind, farmers' transportation of it, seeding, and so on. And if that happens to anyone, whether an organic farmer, conventional farmer, you no longer own your seeds or plants under patent law. They become the ownership of Monsanto. So that was pretty devastating. He also ruled that we were no longer to use our seeds or plants again, and any crop or seeds that we had left, or canola or rapeseed we had left, now goes to Monsanto. All our research and development goes to Monsanto. Another thing he ruled, rate of contamination does not matter. Whether it's a half of 1% or 1% or 5%, you no longer own your seeds or plants that are the ownership of Monsanto. You can imagine how devastated we were with that ruling that all what we had worked for 50 years was now gone and we were not allowed to use our seeds again. So we had the next avenue we had left was the Federal Court of Appeal. So we applied for leave of appeal and the Federal Court of Appeal granted us that they would hear the case. Now we had three judges. And in the Federal Court of Appeal, You can only address points of law or facts of law or where the trial judge erred in law. You couldn't bring in any other thing besides that. So after another 2 years, it finally went to the Federal Court of Appeal, came down with their decision, and they said they would uphold the trial judge's, all of his decisions, although they didn't agree with some of them. And that really raised eyebrows in the legal circles in Canada, because if you didn't agree with all of the trial judge's decision, it should have been thrown out. But that didn't happen. So now we lost twice. And we have spent, at that time already, about 4.5 years, we had spent over $300,000 in legal costs, lawyer fees, disbursement costs, to fight Monsanto. So we decided that we would put everything on the line, mortgage our land and so on, and apply to the federal court, the Supreme Court of Canada. Now, the lawyers told us we had 10 or 11% chance that the Supreme Court of Canada would hear the case. And you can imagine how happy we were when the Supreme Court of Canada ruled in our favor that they would hear the case. But in the meantime, in that period, Monsanto laid another lawsuit against us, which a lot of people don't know about, and that was for $1 million. And they said they wanted for their legal bills up to date that they had paid and their disbursement costs. So we had to go to court to fight the $1 million charge. So after another year of battle on that, the federal court judge had also heard that case, ruled that we didn't have to pay Monsanto $1 million, but we would have to pay them $159,000. But they stated we didn't have to pay any money until the final avenue of appeal is exhausted, which was the Supreme Court. So Monsanto immediately, to stop us borrowing any more money on our land, they tried to seize our land, they tried to seize our house, they tried to seize our bank accounts, they tried to seize our all our farm equipment, to stop us, liens and caveats, to stop us from borrowing money so we couldn't fight them anymore. So that was another lawsuit we had to fight. Now, in the Supreme Court, we could bring in other items besides patent infringement. And some of these were this. First of all, we said this: can genetic modified traits invade and become noxious weeds that then become resistant to weed killers, which we now have on the prairies, which we call super weeds? Another important issue we brought forward to the Supreme Court was this: can living organisms, seeds, plants, genes, human organs be owned and protected by corporate patents on intellectual property? Another item we brought forward: can farmers' right to grow conventional or organic crops be protected? Another one was, can farmers keep the ancient right to own, save their own seeds and develop them further if they so wish? But the most important issue by that time to my wife and myself, we said to the Supreme Court, who owns life? Has anyone the right, any corporation, any individual the right to put a patent on any higher life form? So those were the issues then before the Supreme Court, besides our patent infringement case. Now, this is what the Supreme Court ruled. And what the decision from the Supreme Court echoed around the world immediately. First of all, they said in our case on the patent infringement, we would not have to pay Monsanto no money, because we did not benefit by being contaminated. We had no benefit by having GMOs in our field or in our crop. And furthermore, they said because we never had used Monsanto's glyphosate or Roundup on our crop, we never really used the patent. But what was not fair, the Supreme Court ruled, we have to pay our own legal bills up to that point in time. Monsanto has to pay their own legal bill. Our legal bill at that time already was over $400,000. Monsanto's legal bill was over $2 million. And believe me, it's a lot easier for a corporation, a multi-billion dollar corporation, to pay $2 million for a test case, because they wanted to see, as they said in court, how far they could exercise intellectual property rights over the farmers' rights. And for us as a farmer to stand up for the rights of farmers to pay $400,000. And that was not fair. Now the other issue of who owns life. This is the ruling, and it's a very important ruling to remember. And that's from the Supreme Court. Monsanto's patent on a gene is valid. And wherever that gene arrives, in any higher life form, they own and control that life form, that higher life form. So now we have more problems than we have answers. How far do you go with the patents on higher life form? Can you go all the way to the human being? And that's, the Supreme Court then went on to say, it has to go back to the Parliament of Canada to see, to bring in new laws and new regulations to protect life. And that has not happened yet. And also that the rights of farmers have to be protected. So that was the ruling of the Supreme Court. It was a 5-4 decision. Now, with 4 judges voting on our side and 5 for Monsanto. Now, I think Monsanto thought they had won a great victory when the Supreme Court ruled they own and control that higher life form. But what has happened, now we have entered a liability area. Because if you own and control a higher life form and you put it into the environment where you cannot control cross-pollination or direct seed movement or whatever, then you should be liable for the damages. So as a result of that ruling, my wife and I watched our land very carefully after that for any further contamination. And sure enough, in 2005, we noticed that there were canola plants growing on a field that we were preparing for the development of yellow mustard, because we did not dare to grow canola anymore, or rapeseed, because the judge had also ruled if a farmer ought to or should know if his seeds or his plants or his soil is contaminated with Monsanto's GMOs, and if you grow any other crop but Monsanto's, you can lose your rights or you can be fined. So we didn't dare to ever grow Monsanto's GMOs again, or any canola, because we knew that the seed was contaminated, we knew our soil was contaminated. So anyway, there were canola plants growing on this 50-acre field that we were going to use for new development. And it had no crop on that year because we maintained weed control by cultivation to have yellow mustard seeded the next year. And in September of 2005, going out to the field one day, I noticed these canola plants growing. And that field didn't have canola in for at least 10 years. And we were very startled about it, so we immediately started doing tests, and we used Monsanto's Roundup. And we took 10 or 12 plants, and we put small amounts with a little spray bottle on leaves of 10 or 12 plants. We waited 12 days to see what would happen to the plants, and the plants did not die. And Monsanto had said to all the court systems that if anything is sprayed, any green thing that is sprayed with Monsanto's Roundup herbicide, and it doesn't die, it's their gene that's in that plant. So we knew then that Monsanto, it had to be Monsanto's GMO rapeseed. We notified Monsanto and said, we believe that there's some of your GMO rapeseed again in our field, contaminating our field that we're going to use now for mustard research. They said they would come out and check. And 2 days later, indeed, they did come. They looked at the plants that we had sprayed. We had marked them. They took other samples of other plants. And after 2 or 3 days, they notified us, yes, indeed, it is their GMO canola again on or rapeseed on our in our field. And they asked us, what did we want to have done with the contamination? These canola plants grown throughout the 50 acres. And we said to them, because we're going to do mustard research, we want every canola plant from the 50 acres pulled out by hand. And they agreed to do this. And but 2 days later, my wife gets a notice or a fax from Monsanto, and in it it says, before we'll come and remove those plants, you have to sign this release form. And in that release form that they had sent to my wife, there was a whole paragraph blacked out. And my wife contacted Monsanto and said that there is no way we're going to sign a release form unless we know what's in the total document. So So they agreed to send her another form without it being blacked out. And when they sent that form, if I ever saw my wife excited or to the point of being angry, was when she showed me that release form. In that release form, it said this: my wife, myself, or any member of our family could never ever take Monsanto to court again for the rest of our lives, no matter how much they contaminated us on that field in the future. The other important thing in there was a gag order, which they got hundreds of farmers in North America always assigned, that we could never ever talk to the press, we could never talk to our neighbors or anyone. I couldn't even talk to you here this evening what the terms of settlement were. And we said to Monsanto, there is no way that we're ever going to give our freedom of speech away, especially to a corporation, and we refused to sign it. Monsanto said, if you don't sign it, we will not remove the plants. And we said then to Monsanto, we will remove the plants, we will get help and remove all the plants. Then Monsanto sent us a letter and said, we wish to advise you that those plants in your field are our property, and you're not allowed to do with them what you want. And I said to them, okay, get your property off of our property. You're trespassing. And they said, we'll sign the document. And so it went back and forth. And finally, we notified Monsanto on a certain days, we will remove the plants. And so we did. And we notified Monsanto when it was done, what did you want done? We asked them, what did you want done with these plants? And they said, you can't do with them what you want. I said, they're on a pile. Come and get them. So anyway, they said, we will not do anything unless you sign the document. So my wife and I sent Monsanto the bill. And we had paid our neighbor $640 to help remove the plants. And Monsanto refused to pay the bill. They said, unless you sign the document. So this went back and forth for a year. And then finally we decided, what are we going to do? We knew that if we go to court, Monsanto, we could end up at the Supreme Court of Canada, another 7 or 8 years of our life, probably another $200,000-$400,000. So we made that decision, we would take Monsanto to court to pay the bill. So we sent the bill, but they refused to pay. Then I thought the best way I could do is go to small claims court, where I could get Monsanto into court quite quickly and easily. Went to the judge and he said, send Monsanto another bill. We did. Well, we said, we've been doing this. He said, send them another bill. If they don't pay it in 10 days, come back. And in 10 days, we did come back. And the judge issued Monsanto a summons, and we had a multi-billion-dollar corporation in court on a $640 bill, because the judge issued Monsanto the summons. So in March of this year, it went to court. And when the judge came into court, Monsanto's lawyer and Monsanto's representative got up. They had a check in hand for $660, and they paid the bill. We didn't have to sign a release statement, and that was a great victory, not only for ourselves, but a great victory for farmers all over the world, because now you have an avenue. If you are contaminated, you can take Monsanto to court, or Bayer, or Syngenta, or whatever, because the door has been opened, because they accepted that liability on the contamination issue. And so after 10 years of legal battle, it was a great victory, not only for ourselves, but for farmers around the world. So you can stand up to them now. Now, I'd like to go on the issue of GMOs. Why did farmers start growing GMOs in 1996 in U.S. and Canada? And they were told these things like increased yields, less chemicals, more nutritious, paleo-hungry world, sustainable agriculture. Exactly the opposite has happened. And some of the things I'm going to say here this evening will startle you. What can happen if you introduce GMOs? Because it has happened to us. We've had now GMOs for 13 years, 13 full crops. And so it's no longer of what can happen or may happen, but does happen if you ever introduce GMOs. So immediately, the yields start going down. As was mentioned before, the chemical, you can expect 3 to 5 times more chemical use if you introduce GMOs. And the chemicals you have to use now, the new super weeds that have been developed, 3 to 5 times more chemical, plus more highly and more powerful and more toxic chemicals. And also the nutritional content is maybe only 50%. So now we have increased chemical use, less yields, and not as nutritious. But worst of all, the two, three very important things to remember. There is absolutely no coexistence. You will destroy the organic farmers like we've destroyed them in Canada. You will destroy a conventional farmer because you no longer have a choice. The GMO gene is the dominant gene and will take over whatever seeds or species of plants you put it into. So there's no coexistence. There is no containment. I don't care if you have 50 kilometers or 100 miles, you cannot contain pollen flow or seeds blown in the wind. The other thing is this. We no longer have any pure canola seed or rapeseed left in Canada. And in our whole country, it's now all GMOs. We no longer have any pure soya left in Canada. It is now all GMOs. So choice, you no longer have a choice in those two crops. And so those are two crops organic farmers in Canada no longer can raise organically because our total seed supply is now GMOs. If you get soya from Canada, if you get rapeseed or canola from Canada, it all has GMO in it. It will vary to the degree. Some of it is almost 100%, even though it was raised as conventional canola. So you no longer have a choice. To go a little farther on that, we have another major problem, is that rapeseed comes from the brassica family. And in that family, you have very close cousins, radishes, turnips, cauliflower, and so on, and distant cousins, mustard, well mustard. Through cross-pollination, the GMO gene has gone now from the canola or rapeseed into those market garden crops, making more crops organic farmers no longer can raise. So when you hear, when I come to Europe and I hear it and they say, you can have coexistence, you have a choice, you do absolutely no longer have a choice. And we found that out the hard way in Canada. And we're paying a heavy price for that now. Because the economic issue has been devastating. We can no longer sell our canola to many countries of the world. We no longer can sell our soya. But worse still, it has affected another industry, our honey producers. No longer can ship their honey to many countries of the world because our honey now is contaminated with GMOs. And basically, a bee doesn't know which flower is GMO and which flower is not. So it's ruined another industry. So it goes on and on and on. So I have not come here to England to tell you what to do. I'm here to tell you what has happened to us as Canadian farmers. You have a choice here yet. And the choice you make will be your choice. But remember, we do not know, once you introduce it, if you ever can recall it back. And scientists from all over the world have told us that at the present time, they don't know if you ever can recall it back at GMO. And then what would you recall back in the case of rapeseed, when it's cross-pollinated into radishes, turnips, and cauliflower, and ruined those market garden producers? So what would you recall back? So once you make that decision, remember, it's a point of no return. And I think it's very important for all of us that are here this evening, and it was very important to my wife and myself, that we have 5 children and 15 grandchildren and a great-grandchild. And what kind of a future do we want to leave to the future generations, our children, grandchildren, and so on? Do we want to leave land and soil and water and air full of poisons? I don't think none of us want to do that. Now, there's a big concern at the present time on the liability issue in Canada. If you are contaminated, who pays? And the other issue is the food issue. There's a lot of concern now about the food issue because we have a lot of information from throughout the world, the effects on human health, and I won't go into that this evening, but if some of you are after the meeting, I will tell you more about that. So the important three things, no choice left, no such thing as coexistence, and no containment. Now there's another issue I think that's very important that has arisen with the introduction of GMOs that you never ever hear about in Europe and other parts of the world. And that's the whole issue of the social fabric of our people breaking down, or especially amongst our rural society, where And that has come about because of the contracts and the extortion letters and also pamphlets that Monsanto sends out to farmers. And I'll just briefly show you one of their contracts that they use in Western Canada, a little bit changed in the U.S. And in it states this: a farmer is never allowed to use his own seed. He must always buy the seed from Monsanto. He must buy the chemicals only from Monsanto. He must pay Monsanto about $15 an acre, a license fee each year on each acre that he owns. He must permit Monsanto's police force to come on his land for 3 years after he signs a contract, even though he may only grow the GMO crop 1 year. These gene police, as we call them in Canada, can go on your land, they can go in your granary, they can get your tax records, your farming records, with or without your permission. And another clause is that if you commit some violation of this contract, you must sign this non-disclosure statement, which my wife and I designed, where you can never talk to your neighbor or to the press what Monsanto has done to you. If they made you destroy all your crop or took all the profit from your crop, you can never ever talk about it. There's some other clauses in here. Well, I should mainly mention, who are Monsanto's police? In Canada, they're former Royal Canadian Mounted Police. In the United States, they hire Pinkerton Investigation Services. Monsanto's police in Canada are based in my home airport city of Saskatoon. Last year, they had 35 former RCMP or Royal Canadian Mounted Police on staff. Monsanto has a budget in North America of $10 million each year with 70 lawyers on staff, and all they do is to prosecute farmers or investigate farmers. So those are some of the things you never hear about. A new clause they had for 2008 was this. If something goes wrong with your crop, if you're growing a GMO crop, you can never take Monsanto to court on whatever what has happened to your crop. So you give up your right to take Monsanto to court. So that's another clause in the latest contract. So they have total control over a farmer. So what it means, total control of the seed and food supply. That's what GMOs were all about. It doesn't matter now whether a farmer signs a contract or not with Monsanto. If you are contaminated, naturally against your wishes, if you're an organic farmer or conventional farmer, you fall under the same conditions as if you signed a contract. And the other point is that if you open up a bag of seed from Monsanto now, on the bag it states, by opening up this bag of seed, you agree to all the terms and conditions of Monsanto's patent number so-and-so. So you don't have to sign that contract to come under the thumb of Monsanto. That's one thing. But I think the next thing I'm going to show you, I'm talking about a first world country. I'm not talking about some third world country. We never thought this could happen to us. Here's a brochure from Monsanto. And in it, it states here, if you think your neighbor is growing Monsanto's GMOs without a license, you should inform on your neighbor. And if you do that, Monsanto will give you a free gift. Primarily in Western Canada, you'll get a free leather jacket from Monsanto. And believe me, right now, there's very few farmers wearing a Monsanto jacket. But anyway, or you'll get free chemicals. And if a farmer happens to do that to his neighbor for whatever reason, Monsanto will immediately send out two of their investigators or former police, whatever, to a farmer's home. And what happens is not nice. They'll say to a farmer and his wife, we have this HIPAA rule where you're growing GMOs without a license. And a farmer will say, I'm an organic farmer, I'm a conventional farmer, we don't want you to use your seed. And Monsanto's gene police will say, you're lying, if you don't confess, we'll take you to court, and the time we're through with you, you won't have a farm left. And I'm not talking about isolated cases. I'm talking about hundreds and hundreds of cases. So when these gene police leave a farmer's home, this is what happens normally. A farmer will think, well, which neighbor has caused me this trouble? The neighbor here, over there, has put me through this. And so now you have that breakdown of relationship between farmers. Farmers not trusting one another. Farmers scared to talk about their seeding on coffee roll and so on. So it's a whole total breakdown of a real social fabric. And I often think back in my own family, when my grandparents came from here around 1890, And my grandparents and my parents, because I'm only a third generation farmer, they had to work together with our neighbors and to build our roads, schools, hospitals, churches, all our infrastructure of our country. Now you have that breakdown of working together. And as a former member of the legislature, I feel that is one of the worst things that could have happened with the introduction of GMOs, the breakdown of our rural social fabric. So I don't know how many calls my wife and I have had from farm women crying on the phone and saying, Monsanto's gene police been here, they threaten us. We won't have a farm left, what should we do? And we'll try and advise them where they can get legal help. So these are things that you never ever hear about if you ever introduce GMOs, the whole breakdown of our society, of people working together. I think I have enough time to show you one other document. And we don't know how many thousands of these have been sent out in North America. But I've been able to get even some of the original letters from letters that were sent to a farmer by Monsanto. Farmers call these extortion letters. And believe me, if you and I would do something like that, we'd be thrown in jail, but Monsanto gets away with it. And in this letter, especially if a farmer has said something negatively about Monsanto, or Monsanto couldn't find a farmer at home, they can get his mailing address from the local municipality or whatever. And in this letter, it states this: we have reason to believe that you might be growing Monsanto's GMOs without a license. We estimate you have 200 acres, 300 acres or so, whatever. And in lieu of us not taking you to court, send us $200,000, $100,000 in 2 weeks' time, and we may or may not take you to court. Another sentence here, it says, you're not allowed to show this letter to anyone or we will fine you. Can you imagine the fear in a farm family when they get a letter from a billion-dollar corporation, send us $200,000 in 2 weeks' time because we think you might be growing Monsanto's GMO. Talk about intimidation and fear and extortion, and they're getting away with it. Because to do something, you have to lay a charge against Monsanto, and Monsanto will fight you in courts, and you might end up in court for 2-3 years and cost you $200,000 or $300,000. We often say in Canada, we have a legal system, but do we really have justice for the average person when it comes to fighting corporations? We do not. And things have to be changed. So those are some of the things that have happened with the introduction of GMOs. To further get control of the seed supply, this is what else they have done. And I'm not only talking now about Monsanto, but Monsanto is on the forefront of this. First of all, they tried to introduce the Terminator gene 3 years ago, and I think most of you know what that is, but basically it's a gene that's put into a seed. When the seed becomes a plant, all the seeds from that plant are sterile, and it cannot be used for further seeding. So it's a control of future life where you always have to go back to buy your seed. But the danger of the Terminator gene, it also can cross-pollinate into your neighbor's crop and also render his seeds from his crop also sterile. We say in North America and in Canada, it's the greatest assault on life that we've ever seen on this planet before when they come up with a gene that terminates future life. The danger with the Terminator gene also is going to be installed or inserted into any higher-like form, and that's very scary. Terminator gene. Next gene we have now, they tried to introduce, we gave it the name of the cheater gene. The cheater gene works in conjunction with the Terminator gene, where both genes are put into a seed. The seed will produce a plant, but the plant will not produce a seed unless you spray it with a chemical. When you spray it with a chemical, the plant will produce the seed, then the Terminator gene kicks in and renders the seed sterile. So that again would give them total control of the seed supply. The latest one out now is called the mutant gene, where the seed will not germinate unless you spray a chemical on it. So that will give them total control of the world seed supply. And that's what it's all about. So I think it's very important. There's a lot more to GMOs than just seeds and plants, or what they tell you, increased yields and more nutrition. There's the whole control of people, the freedom of speech, freedom of expression. Another area that we're very concerned about in Canada especially, we do not have labeling. We don't know what's in our food. 91% of the Canadian people in a survey taken 3 years ago said they would not eat GMO food if they knew what was in our food. And we're fighting hard to get that law passed that we have labeling so we know what we're feeding to our children, what we're eating or feeding to our grandchildren. And you can imagine how the corporations are fighting that. Why do I pick out Monsanto? First of all, naturally, I had a lawsuit with them. But there's more reasons for that. Monsanto is the only company in the world that does not want a farmer to use his seed from year to year. All the other companies in North America will allow a farmer to use his seed from year to year, providing he doesn't brown bag it or sell it to his neighbor. So, but Monsanto does not want to permit that. Secondly, Monsanto now is the largest seed company in the world. They've been buying up seed companies in the last 5-6 years, spending somewhere in the neighborhood of $14 billion. Many of the seed companies. They just bought a seed company that primarily sold organic seed in California not long ago. 3,500 varieties of organic seeds under the control of Monsanto, just from one company in California. So you can see what they're after. What about what did Louise and I really go through? 7 years in the original case, 7 years ago, go to court. It was like a living hell. And we wish it on nobody. We had the opportunity and we had the resources to fight Monsanto. But they tried to break us down mentally, they tried to watch and destroy us financially. But we kept on fighting. And as I said before, if it wouldn't have been for her and our family and our friends, we could never, ever have stood up to them. This is what they did to us. They would watch us, not only us, but thousands of other farms. They would watch us every day when we worked in our fields. They would sit with their vehicles along the road and watch us day after day after day. They would come into our driveway and watch and sit in our driveway and watch what my wife was doing. She would get phone calls. You better watch it. They're going to get you. Then they would go to our neighbors and say, if you support Kirsten and Louise Schweizer, we're going to come after you. And the time we're through with you, you won't have a farmland. So you can imagine, when my neighbors would come and talk to me, they would look this way to see if anybody was watching, if they were talking to me. That's how much fear they were able to install, not only in our community, but thousands of communities throughout both our countries. So to put that fear in, and what better way than to control people than by fear? One time when my wife and I were speaking at the parliament in South Africa, in Cape Town, we gave a presentation, and Monsanto demanded that they have equal time, but the governor, the parliament agricultural minister gave Monsanto 5 minutes, and he basically bombed out. He said, there is no such thing as cross-pollination. There is no such thing that seeds can blow in the wind. And he got laughed at in the African Parliament. And coming out the door, we ran face to face with Wally Green, Monsanto's rep from Johannesburg. And he shook his fist in my wife's face and my face and said, nobody stands up to Monsanto. We're going to get you. We're going to get you both and somehow destroy you somehow someday. So you can imagine the fear that we've always lived in. And even today, when I go to third world countries, I do look over my shoulder. So this is what happens when you introduce GMOs. And I think it's important that you know the other side of the story. But again, if you want to destroy your organic farmers in your country here, just introduce GMOs, because remember, you no longer will have a choice. And organics now, and that's why we've had 13 crops GMOs in Canada, but no new GMO crops have been allowed in Canada since that time, although they wanted to introduce rice, wheat, alfalfa, flax, and permission was not given because we've seen, and the government has seen, the damage the first four crops, have done. Why would you want to start growing GMOs when we're stopping them in North America? And it's something to think about. Because, as I said, I have not come here to tell you what to do. I've come here to give you an awareness of what has happened to us as Canadian and American farmers. There are many other areas, but I think I'll stop at this point, and I think the chair, you know, would like to have questions. We have a question period, and I'm sure that there might be other areas that I didn't touch on. So again, I touched on the terminator gene, the issue on the, well, first of all, I should say this. There's been major damage done to our environment, because when you start using 3 to 5 times more chemicals than you did before, you can imagine the damage it does to the environment, also to human health. You cannot increase chemical use without more harmful human health. So that's an issue. But another issue that my wife and I were very concerned about, being seed developers, we realized at the time that the loss of biodiversity. If you get down to one variety of seeds or plants in any given field, and you have some disease, some blight, some disaster, you've got nothing to fall back on. And that's what we were very concerned about. So you lose your biodiversity, you lose your indigenous seeds, your heirloom seeds, and your pedigree seeds. You no longer have a choice. So with that, again, my wife and I often have said, she is 76, I'm 77, we're both going to be a year older in a few weeks. And we said, as long as we have life in us, we're going to go down fighting for the rights of farmers all over the world, always to have the right to use their seeds from year to year. And that's one of the reasons we're giving our time to journey around the world to bring you this message. Again, the choice you make will be your choice, but if you introduce it 2 years from now, you cannot say we did not know. Thank you again for the invitation to come to England.